You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 24th of March 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show, Brussels 2 days on, Belgium attempts to come to terms with the scale of Tuesday's terror attacks and the size of the network that perpetrated them. Amid questions and recriminations, two ministers offer their resignations. My guests Mary Dajewski and Michael Binion will be joining me for an extended discussion of that and of the overdue settling of accounts with one of the men who attempted to murder Bosnia.
The accused bears individual criminal responsibility pursuant to Article 7(1) of the statute for murder, unlawful attacks on civilians, and terror as violations of the laws or customs of war, and for murder as a crime against humanity.
It has taken 20 years to give Radovan Karadzic 40 years. That's in the second half of the show. That's all coming up on Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, on Monocle 24 right now. So welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Mary Dajewski, columnist for The Independent and The Guardian, who will join us presently, and Michael Binion, foreign affairs writer and former diplomatic editor of The Times. For the first part of tonight's show, we're going to stay with Brussels. It's now a little over 2 days since 31 people were killed and many dozens injured in terrorist bombings at the city's Zaventem airport and at Malbik metro station. Among developments today, Turkey has said that one of the suspects was deported to the EU from Turkey. Belgium's interior and justice ministers have offered their resignations, both refused by the Prime Minister. And Salah Abdeslam, the alleged orchestrator of last November's similar attacks in Paris, whose arrest in Brussels last week is thought to have been a trigger for Tuesday's bombings, has decided that he will not, after all, fight extradition to France. Michael, 48 hours and change later, there is a narrative seems to be coalescing that that the bombing, while obviously entirely the culpability of the actual bombers, was abetted, I guess, unconsciously by the official ineptitude in Belgium. Is there something to that, that this was more likely to happen in Belgium because its monitoring of these people had been so lackadaisical? Or is this a measure of wishful thinking by everybody else that it couldn't possibly happen here, and here's why?
No, I'm afraid there is quite a bit in it, that the Belgian police and security forces are not very well integrated. Belgium is a country that is devolved not only between Wallonia and Flanders, it's not only two halves, but even between various districts. And in Brussels itself, there are something like 19 different districts and 19 different police authorities. And they don't talk to each other, they don't pass information up or down or sideways. There's not much coordination with police service, police forces overseas, and in fact there's so many occasions when information could get lost or not passed on or things of this kind. They know about it, they've been told about it, they've been warned about it many times, and in fact Turkey's made that absolutely clear today when the president said, why didn't they heed the warning we gave them about this man that we expelled back? So I'm afraid it is partly Belgium's fault that they weren't able to be sharper in catching the warning signs.
Mary, what do you think? We were just discussing this narrative that has been building around the idea that Belgium was more susceptible to this attack than other countries may have been due to a measure of bungling, incompetence and dysfunction in its law enforcement. It turns out today that Belgium was ordered 3 weeks ago by the European Council to sort out its border force, which hadn't been bothering to check suspicious passengers against counter-terrorism databases. We have, of course, the example of Salah Abdeslam, who had apparently spent 4 months living in, frankly, exactly the first place you would think someone would go looking for him. It's a really vague and open-ended question. How is this even possible, that the chaos that Michael was describing is able to develop?
Well, I think Michael is absolutely right about the sort of fragmented nature of Belgian law enforcement and the Belgian state. But I think it's in some ways very unfair to look at Belgium in this way, because, you know, it is a small country, and until quite recently there was no reason for it to have state-of-the-art anti-terrorist, that intelligence, that international cooperation at every level. And suddenly, you know, people are demanding that it should have had this all along. So I think
it's a common thing, though. It's like we should always have had this stuff that we didn't know we needed until just now.
Well, of course, and that included Britain. I mean, when the bomb attacks happened in London, 7/7, there was all sorts of inquests into what had gone wrong. And although there were sort of heroic actions by everybody who was involved and at the front line, nonetheless, there were intelligence failings. And one of the most horrendous things was the fact that it was discovered that emergency service radios didn't operate underground. I mean, communications just fell completely to pieces. So while Britain sort of boasts of being state of the art about this sort of thing, I think nobody actually, when they come under this degree of scrutiny, comes out absolutely brilliantly.
Well, I would say to that two things. First of all, Belgium has a very high concentration of immigrants from North Africa, largely Morocco, who are notoriously unintegrated in Belgian society. So already
this is a parallel to a situation we see in France and Paris in particular.
Exactly, yes. They are living on the margins of society, and they're all clustered in a particular suburb, or several particular suburbs of Brussels. Poorly policed, it's got problems with unemployment, petty criminality, and all that kind of thing. That's one problem. And secondly, just because Belgium is a relatively small country, it's not that small, it's got 10 million people. If you look at, say, a country with half the population, like Norway or Switzerland or perhaps Sweden, which is a little bit more, they have far, far more integrated and tougher security measures. And there's been plenty of time for these countries to get their act together, because there's been a lot of worry about what's been happening for the past 5 years. So, I mean, I agree with you that you can't blame a country. And I think it's perfectly honourable and right that both the justice and the interior ministers should have offered their resignations. I think in the circumstances, it was probably right to refuse them, because there's plenty of work to do now and you can't have a change of personnel
at a critical
moment.
No.
But I think they were right to take moral responsibility for it.
I want to talk about the wider, I guess, resonance of these attacks as it started to make itself clear in the last 48 hours. Mary, it does seem to have been one of those events which has somehow proved that everything everybody thought was right all along. In this country in particular, it has been somewhat clumsily incorporated into the campaign one way or the other coming up to the EU in-out referendum, and I cannot believe there's still 3 months of this to go. This suggestion that was floated gracelessly early by a few out proponents that Britain would somehow be protected from such attacks if it was outside the EU. Is that as ridiculous as it sounds?
Well, the arguments that are advanced are largely that Britain would gain greater control over its borders. Now, you have to say that Britain's control over its borders, even though it's not in Schengen and not part of the sort of borderless inside of Europe, our border controls are not spectacularly wonderful. So I think that some toughening up needs to be done there if we can boast that our border is effective. Where the people who say that out would improve things on this score may have a point is that because of the Schengen zone and because of the borderless Europe, a European citizen finds it much easier to get to the border of the UK, and with a European passport will be looked at with probably more tolerance and less scrutiny trying to get into the UK. So to that extent, they have a point. But what has been so interesting, just in the last 24 hours, we've had two former heads of British security, MI6 Foreign Intelligence, who have come out on either side of the argument. And one of them said, we would be better out, and is using it to using Belgium as a reason why the British would be better out. And then one of his successors came out and said, no, we need the security cooperation that we get inside Europe, and we would lose a huge amount if we left. So those are very high-level people with huge amounts of expertise coming out on opposite sides.
Michael, what have you made of the wider political response? It strikes me, at least, that political leaders are starting to struggle to find new or interesting things to say about events like this. It's almost becoming Europe's equivalent of the American school shooting. It's the events are horrific, though they are broadly similar, and there seems to be quite a limited set of responses. And once you've made those responses X number of times, you start to sense an amount of, I think, existential ennui in the politicians making those statements.
Well, that's true, but the trouble is that every time one of these things happens, several things get worse. And the thing that gets worse is the general atmosphere inside the country towards Muslims or towards outsiders. And the level of Islamophobia throughout Europe, in Britain and in Germany particularly, in a large number of countries, is rising. And it is becoming a general accusation that Muslims tolerate this sort of extremist violence. And I think the onus on moderate Muslim leaders to say, no, we don't, is ever stronger. They have to really show that they're making every effort to eradicate this within the thinking of the Muslim community. Now, outsiders such as Donald Trump will use it as a blanket accusation. All Muslims are terrorists, and absurd accusations of this kind, which the British Interior Minister, the Home Secretary, has just said is outrageous. But that is a growing feeling, and so is a populist, simplistic, right-wing desire for a tough law and order measure that would simply keep foreigners out. Now, neither of those are the right response, but both of them are made worse every time something of this happens.
But I think, I mean, not just in Britain, but across Europe, Belgium has played into the debate about migration. In the UK, it's not just in out of Europe, it's also the question of migration. And everywhere, not just the fact that several of the people in Belgium appear to have crossed borders and come in undercover in a couple of cases from Syria via the Turkish migrant route, that this is being used as an argument to say that all migrants therefore have to be suspect, and it's going to impact very, very negatively on the cause of justified refugees.
I mean, to which the obvious retort is that, as far as we know, I think I'm right in saying, neither the Paris attacks nor these attacks in Brussels were perpetrated by refugees or, I think, even immigrants. These are all Belgian and French citizens.
Indeed, homegrown, as were the ones in Britain 10 years ago. I mean, they are homegrown attacks, and that is part of the problem. And, of course, that raises the question about whether our integration within Britain, and particularly in a country such as Belgium, is going anywhere near far enough to make to stop these young people feeling disillusioned and alienated. A particular source of difficulty is the prison system, where a lot of petty criminals get into prison and then, having had no interest in violent jihad, suddenly are radicalized in prison because it gives them a cause, a kind of different narrative. They suddenly feel they're somebody, they've got a cause, and they come out ready-made terrorists.
There was another obvious and commonplace official reaction to events like this. There's been a lot of reiterations of warnings against, I think at one point we were up to all but vital travel to Brussels. The Foreign Office was warning people off. Is that an overreaction? Would you be perfectly happy to go to Brussels right now?
I would be overjoyed to go to Brussels
It is a nice city. People forget
this. It's a wonderful city. And I think what surprised me positively is the response of Brussels to what's happened, actually, because although law enforcement, and now with hindsight it looks completely justifiably, responded after the Paris attacks, they brought practically troops and paramilitaries out on the streets, armoured cars, tanks. There was a sort of quasi-military response specifically in Brussels to what had happened, which wasn't the case in the UK. But I think that the response of as it were, ordinary people in Brussels, all the people who came out to overnight vigils, who chalked graffiti onto the pavement, onto the square in front of the Bourse, all that is something that, personally, I hadn't expected of Belgians, and I think it reflects very well on them.
There was a final thought that I wanted to put to you both. I'll ask you first, Michael. You mentioned the July 7th bombings in 2005 in London, and I can remember at the time I thought London reacted to those, dreadful though they were, with, you know, fairly sort of laudable London-like, you know, hauteur and resilience, just a kind of a, well, okay, these things happen from time to time. But I remember a couple of weeks later when there was the attempted bombings which didn't quite work. That, I thought, made people even more nervous because it prompted the question, which is the question I'm going to put to you, is like, what happens if this keeps happening?
Yes, exactly. It's a bit like saying what happened in the Second World War when the first V1 rocket fell on London. People were terrified. Well, the V2 even more. People were terrified and they said, well, we'll carry on as we did. And then they fell again and again and again. And in fact, people were terrified by the end of the war because these things came without warning. It wasn't just you heard a plane, you heard nothing, and suddenly a bomb exploded. So it came out of thin air, as it were. And there is that worry. And I think people will be frightened for a while, but there is a certain resilience. And people will say, well, we carry on. You know, we just have to keep going. There was talk in London, certainly, of shall we set up airport-style security at the entrance to all underground stations? And within a few days, people said that's utterly impractical. That cannot happen.
But which, and I'll put to you the same question, Mary, with an asterisk, with that written under it, because the other potentially disturbing development of the, you know, of this particular bombing is that they appear to have realised that you don't need, and this has been this bizarre fixation with jihadis with aeroplanes for years, and they seem to have realised now you don't actually need to go to all that trouble. You command exactly the same amount of media coverage, you cause exactly the same amount of terror by just walking into the part of the airport that anybody can walk into. If this does become a regular occurrence, where does that start to lead us?
Well, it leads us with redesigning a whole lot of Western airports. I mean, it is actually, it's very common, actually, outside most major European airports to have to go through a security check actually to enter the airport premises at all. So this isn't something without precedent. It's not something unusual to have those sort of checks. Where I think the problem, the further problem arises is that, I mean, I agree with Michael. I think London in particular is renowned for this thing called resilience, and it is a huge quality. I mean, any British government has an enormous plus in comparison with most other countries of the world, simply in the resilience and the sang-froid of Londoners. So I think that is an asset, and it's an asset not to be underestimated. But yes, 2 weeks later, when there was the attempt that was prevented on the London Underground, then I think the whole place felt much more jumpy. That the whole atmosphere was quite different. So I think that if we did have to get used to it, then I think the whole way that we would operate and we would move around our cities would change probably quite quickly.
Okay, well, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Miller, along with Mary Dijewski and Michael Binion. Coming up next, justice finally catches up with Radovan Karadzic.
Immerse yourself in the world of Monocle. Visit monocle.com. Listen live to our radio station, Monocle 24, or explore more than 5,000 hours of audio. Every minute of every show we've broadcast since we launched. And don't forget that we have over 400 films to watch and share, while magazine subscribers can log in and browse our complete print archive on screen. Our online shop is here too, which you'll find well stocked with clothing, books, travel accessories, fragrances, homewares, and more. Check into monocle.com every day for fresh news and opinion from our editors and bureau around the globe. Then plan a trip to one of those spots for business or pleasure with our handy city and resort guides. It's all there for you at monocle.com. What are you waiting for?
Yeah. You're welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me are Mary Dijewski and Michael Binion. Now, justice delayed, as the saying goes, is justice denied. And it's just over a few weeks past 20 years since the siege of Sarajevo was finally lifted. It's taken until today for one of its principal perpetrators, the former Bosnian Serb leader Radovan Karadzic, to be formally punished for his role. The UN International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia sentenced Karadzic to 40 years imprisonment after convicting him on 10 of 11 charges, including genocide, war crimes, crimes against humanity. Mary, Karadzic says he'll appeal, and I suppose he might as well. He doesn't appear to be going anywhere else. This does seem about fair enough, though, doesn't it?
Well, I think in the terms in which the court was set up and in the wake of everything that happened during the post-Yugoslav civil war, yes, I think you can say indeed that this is a war crimes tribunal, probably second only to the Nuremberg, and that it follows in that model and that it's entirely within rights, and this is the sort of justice that Karadzic should face. Now, you probably hear in what I'm saying all sorts of hesitation in my voice, because I have problems. I really do have problems with courts that are set up by the victors to judge the defeated. I also have some problems with what are so wonderfully called the rules of war and the law of war, because it seems to me that when countries, or in this case, different groups within the same country are at war, basically all bets are off. And I think it's very difficult to draw a line between what is, as it were, legitimate in warfare and what is deemed necessary to the survival of that particular group. And so I have all sorts of hesitation, and I understand why the people who've been judged in these tribunals, the modern ones I'm talking about, not Nuremberg, the modern ones, why they say this is the justice of the victors.
In what respect do you think Radovan Karadzic was acting in the defence of his group in laying siege to Sarajevo?
I think he would say that that was part of the prosecution of war. And, I don't want to make his defence for him. I mean, his grounds for appealing, as I understand it, he says that there was no proper evidence brought. It was all sort of inference, and it wasn't sort of concrete. And I think that maybe he's misunderstood there, that, if you're a leader, then basically you take responsibility for what happens on your watch. Problems with that.
He has grudgingly admitted to a measure of moral responsibility, but with no particular enthusiasm, I didn't think. Michael, Mary mentioned there Nuremberg, and that, of course, was acquitted with some alacrity, barely a year after the war had ended. It was all pretty much wrapped up. Why has the process, not just with Karadzic, but of bringing war criminals to justice, become so unwieldy? This, as I was saying in the introduction, this has taken 20 years.
Well, several things. I would say one is that the people who have run the courts and the so-called victors of this war have been extremely careful not to fall into the trap that Mary is talking about. That's why I don't agree with Mary on this question of victors' justice. I think it has been remarkably lenient in the sense that they've bent over backwards to hear all the arguments by the defeated, in other words, by Karadzic and the others accused. And that, of course, has taken a great deal of time. Look at the length of time it took to try Milosevic. He died while the trial was going on, the former leader of Serbia. And I think the trial has taken, if I remember, something like 8 years. Of course, it took even longer since the end of the war, because Karadzic went into hiding for about 10 years. He disguised himself and made himself look like a Serbian monk and was hidden in Serbia.
He was a fairly successful New Age practitioner in Novi Beograd for quite some time.
Indeed he was, yes. Well, they caught him, rightly so, and justice delayed is not justice denied. Justice, when it is delivered, is still justice, and I think he deserves every single bit of the sentence given. If it had been Nuremberg, of course, he would have been hanged, but we don't have capital punishment, I think, which is right. But he will die in prison. He's now 70. I don't think he'll be let out early, even for good behaviour. If he ever lives to the age of 110, then he might get out. But he deserves to die in prison. And he takes immediate personal blame. I mean, he could argue perhaps that the siege of Sarajevo was an act of war, but the massacre of 7,000 men in Srebrenica, that was a pure war crime, for which he and the other accused on trial, who I think will be found guilty, Mladic, will bear sole responsibility.
Indeed so. But Mary, this verdict does come a few days after a student dormitory in Pale, the former Bosnian Serb capital, was named after Radovan Karadzic. Protests in his favour have been reported today in Belgrade and elsewhere. And of course, his deputy Momcilo Krajnik received a hero's welcome in Pale when he returned home from prison in 2013. Who are the constituency of these fairly dreadful men? Who still supports them and why?
Well, it's probably true to say that not very many people still support them. There is undoubtedly far more people who won't admit to supporting them than ones who will actually come out into the street. But national sentiment, or what they would call national sentiment, on the part of Bosnia's Serbs, who feel deeply aggrieved that their cause hasn't been recognised as the cause of everybody else involved practically in the Yugoslav civil war, they feel that they fought a war which they lost because so many people, as they would see it, outside the Yugoslav question were on the other side. They feel that the settlement that is now in place cannot be a permanent settlement and that it unduly favours their enemies. And, you know, I don't necessarily agree with them. I mean, I think there is, but I do think there is a problem, again, with civil wars where big powers intervene on the part of one or other, that the resulting settlement is bound to be seen as unjust because it's not been, as they would see it, fought to the finish.
But really, what options would the big powers have? I mean, the argument that is usually arrayed in the case of the intervention in Bosnia was not that it should or shouldn't have happened, but that it should have happened about 4 years earlier.
Yes, I mean, that's all the arguments for intervention. I mean, generally, Yugoslavia is one of the few places where foreign intervention has been seen as not just legitimate, but effective and laudable, and the only problem with it being that it was too late. You know, I have to say, again, that I'm actually quite hostile to the idea of intervention by outsiders in these sort of wars generally. I mean, I think it's a very bad idea, and it leaves this problem that the people who lose feel that they've lost unfairly.
But Michael, is it at least arguable that Karadzic kind of won? I mean, there is Republika Srpska, it exists. It's more or less the kind of, you know, weirdo Serbian state he was fighting for, isn't it?
It is indeed, yes. And I mean, I think it's an unviable state, but it's there. And it seems to exist. It's never going to prosper if it tries to be completely separate from its neighbours. It's part of the Bosnian Federation in name, though actually this settlement isn't working very well. It will take years before those boundaries begin to loosen. It will actually start with people trading across the boundaries, and usually starts with smugglers smuggling goods across the boundary. It will eventually knit together very grudgingly, but these resentments and these horrible hatreds last for years. And what I would say is that the fact that there has been a sentence, an exemplary sentence, on the people who are visibly leaders of some of the most dreadful atrocities, or the instigators of them, does make reconciliation on the ground easier. And that's the same in Rwanda. That's why the génocidaires, the people who are convicted of genocide, need to be seen to be punished to make integration of those who remain in the country easier.
Just a very brief final thought on that, Mary. Whatever your other reservations, do you at least see an argument that if you impose a sentence of this sort on a man like Radovan Karadzic, it is laying down the marker, it is saying that there is behaviour that is not tolerable?
Well, it is, but I think some of the African leaders who have objected to the International Criminal Court are saying that it's basically white colonial justice and that crime is in the eyes of the beholder. I think we've got to be very, very careful to avoid that.
We will have to leave it there. Mary Dejeski and Michael Binion, thank you for joining us. That's all for today's Midori House. It was produced by Marcus Hippie, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, Charlie Young and Mari Giusti. Our studio manager was Christopher Grimes. Carlotta Rebello continues with music on the Atlantic Shift next, 1900. You can hear The Urbanist with Andrew Tuck, and you can have more on the day's main stories on The Daily at 2200. I'll be back with Midori House at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London time. But for now, I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks very much for listening. Goodbye.